Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
Well, hello, and welcome to our weekly program of Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age. If you've listened into prior shows, you know that this program is not about politics. It's about midlife renewal, confronting and conquering common challenges of middle age in your career, at home, and in your community. Our objective for you is a fun-filled, bountiful, and purposeful second half. After all, middle age is the prime time of life. Given that we've just gone through a national election, we're going to change things up a bit this week and talk about finding solutions in Washington, solutions potentially extremely important both to our immediate pocketbooks and to our long-term prospects for retirement, not to mention the future of our children and grandchildren. Clearly, our country is at a crossroads. Simply because the election is over doesn't mean that those of us over 40 should just forget about politics and simply go about our business. We Americans collectively have rehired basically the same bunch of politicians that have led us for the past 4 years, but we demand much more of them this time around. We want major problems solved: unemployment, deficit reduction, health care, education, tax reform, clean energy, and energy independence, just to name a few. How are we going to make sure that both parties get together and end the gridlock? At middle age, you and I have been tested by experiences of 20 or more years of adult living. Most of us have learned to work together and work things out through give and take. Most of those who we've reelected are our contemporaries. After all, despite his appeal to youth, President Barack Obama is one of us. He's 51 and a bona fide member of the baby boom generation. And all the other key players, Boehner, Biden, Pelosi, McConnell, and Reid, are all even older than that. Shouldn't you and I, as fellow members of the 40-plus club, offer our input into solving America's problems? If not us, who will? Just as we urge you each week to take control of your own midlife destiny, forget the labels, let's all band together to influence our country's destiny. And Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, and Mr. Senate Majority Leader, if you're listening in, we welcome you to the conversation and would love to have your input. Those of us over 40, especially those over 50, often are accused by the younger generation of being too set in our ways. That being the case, is it realistic to anticipate improvement over the next 4 years? Today's guest declared, America has lost the ability to reconcile different ideas, perspectives, and interests. And speaking for myself, and I'll bet I speak for a lot of you, I would modify that statement to confess, Roy Richards has lost his ability to reconcile different ideas, perspectives, and interests. Wouldn't it be great if someone could demonstrate a new way of thinking to end this gridlock and dysfunction, both in our personal lives and for our country as a whole? Well, today's guest, Tom Rossman, promises precisely that, a new way of thinking that takes what is useful from both sides, weeds out what isn't, and creates a new set of ideas and solutions. Tom Rossman is an international financial consultant and an expert on emerging markets, and he's the author of the very soon-to-be-released book, The Synthesis Revolution, Becoming Part of the Solution, Not Part of the Problem. That sounds like a pretty good idea. Hello, Tom, and welcome.
Hi, Roy. Thank you very much. Pleasure being here.
Well, let's begin with talking about the problem. You've been studying this phenomenon, I know, for several years. Why have we, as Americans, lost our ability to reconcile different ideas and perspectives and interests? Why have we become so closed-minded and so partisan?
Yeah, I phrase it as being narrow and one-dimensional in our thinking, and that's very profound because, you know, basically, if you look at the history of the modern age, we've created more progress and prosperity, wealth, advances in science, medicine, technology, and longevity in the last 200 years than in the entire rest of human history combined. And the reason that we were able to achieve such amazing accomplishments is that we began in the transition from the medieval world to the modern world, we began to think in entirely new ways about the world and about the problems of society. And that spawned the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment, and the byproducts of that, of course, were the Industrial Revolution, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and all these major events that literally provided the foundation for the modern world. And some of the key drivers of that process we've abandoned. And we've since the early 80s, we've had two ideological partisan coalitions that have been clashing. And originally, it was very successful in the 80s with the some of the prosperity and growth that we experienced there. But from the time Ronald Reagan left office, we've increasingly become more polarized as a society. In fact, according to the Pew Research Foundation, political polarization has nearly doubled in the past 25 years. And that's making it very difficult to find that productive reconciliation.
You know, it's almost like we're returning back to the Middle Ages in our polarity of thinking and our being stuck in our old ways.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the Middle Ages is a great metaphor because it was at the beginning of the early modern period when we were climbing out of the medieval quagmire that we began to look at the world differently. And really the key to that process is objectivity. The objective observation and analysis of the world and the problems of society is really what not only kicked off the amazing changes in social, political, and economic conditions, but also, of course, led to the scientific revolution and all of the amazing discoveries and advances that we've had in technology and medicine and everything else.
You know, I don't recall as a small child, maybe in the 50s and 60s, being told that all Democrats or all Republicans, whichever were miserly, evil, lazy, crazy, uncaring, or stupid. You know, it all just seems like, is that what parents and teachers are telling their children today? It seems like that's all you hear on talk radio is one position or another, and it just, you constantly get blasted, like you say, with these two ideologies.
Yep. Well, let me give you a little context because I think that's important to understand why we're where we are. So from 1932 to 1980, Democrats held control of both the House and the Senate for 44 of the 48 years.
Yes,
so
they
did. So for almost a half a century, Democrats completely controlled the Congress. And the three Republican presidents that were in office during that time period also bought into this expanding government thesis. And that was ushered in 1932 by FDR. And, of course, at that time, government was spending less than 10% of GDP, so you had a wide berth for expanding government thesis to continue to be applicable. And with all the prosperity that happened in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, or the early 70s rather, it wasn't challenged. And then in 1980, of course, Ronald Reagan was elected, and his antithesis to the expanding government thesis was government's not the solution, government's the problem.
Yeah.
But the really interesting part about that is that Reagan was such a great leader that he was able to be what I call personally the individual synthesis. He was able to match his conservative rhetoric with the challenge of a divided government, and also the challenge of, you know, reconciling the differences. Unfortunately, however, since he left office, we've had this polarization that has continued, and of course today the barriers between the sides are so immense that it's difficult to imagine them ever really being effectively crossed.
Yeah, I just heard on the radio today, interesting when I was driving in, that a recent survey said 40% of parents, they always used to ask, you know, when their son or daughter got interested in somebody of the opposite sex and was talking about marriage, now 40% of the parents want to know and express concern over the party affiliation of their potential son or daughter-in-law. And I think that's pretty bad when, you know, that becomes a major issue in marriage.
Oh, yeah. Well, polarization is increasing. In fact, here's a very interesting statistic about polarization. In 1976, the landslide counties, that's counties that voted for one party or the other by more than 20%, it was around 26-27% of the country. In the election of 2008, the 2012 numbers aren't out yet, but in the election of 2008, the landslide counties had increased to almost 50%. So the polarization is happening. There's a lot of scholarship on this from leading sociologists. Interestingly enough, on both the left and the right, who are both making these observations about the increasing polarization of American society.
Well, given that, just give us a brief summary of your concept of synthesis revolution. I know you wrote a whole book on it, but we can't deal with the entire issue. But just give us some feel for how that would work and how we can shift the conversation from problems to solutions and from name-calling to cooperation. You know, it's a huge subject, but how do we get started on this?
Well, the first thing we have to do is we have to understand the origins of modern progress and prosperity. And we have to understand the foundations that led to all this immense prosperity that we've generated over the past several centuries as both Western civilization and as the United States of America. And the process that I describe in the book is one of objective observation and analysis, systematically examining the evidence to determine what's good and useful, and then purifying that through the crucible of the heated crucible of productive debate, and then thirdly, the validation of those potential solutions through experiment and testing. And today we have, if you take the first step, the major barriers to objective observation and analysis are ideology, partisan divisions, and special interests. So these are the three major barriers that stand between the two polarized sides and are preventing us from having that reconciliation that's so important.
And how do we begin to break those darn barriers down? Because,
I'm sorry, Roy. Go ahead.
No, I just go ahead. I'm just so frustrated by this.
Yes. Well, I think the first thing we need to do is we really need to understand how and why those barriers exist. And ideology, for example, basically takes what I call the new thinking, right? The old thinking of ideology takes your perspective and it firmly plants the focus of your perspective to either the left or to the right instead of upward. And what we really need to understand is that the concept of perpetual improvement, which is the idea that drove the success of modern society and of America, is a completely different focus. Not the left, not the right. It's upward, and not in the middle either, because the middle, unfortunately, which a lot of people have tried to sort of gravitate toward, is an area where there's no energy and there's no progress.
That's very true.
Yeah. And then partisan division or partisan tribalism, as they call it, that's something that goes back to the very beginning. You know, George Washington in 1796, in his farewell address, which is very famous for warning about not getting involved in European entanglements, I think deeper meaning of his farewell address is what he called the spirit of party. And he warned the country that two groups that are fighting each other are going to promote their own interests to the detriment of everyone else. and that ultimately will be a very bad framework for decision making. And unfortunately, you know, we have experienced that today, where Democrats and Republicans ferociously battle, not for improving the country and focusing on solutions, but on maintaining positions of power.
Well, do you think that over the next 4 years, we have two things going for us, at least. The Republicans are no longer out to make sure that Barack Obama is not reelected, and Barack Obama is not out to ensure he gets elected again. So is there any possibility that the two parties can begin rationally to work together and get something done to solve all these problems?
Well, I think we're going to make a little bit more progress. At least we'll not go through hopefully the same kind of disaster that we did with the debt limit increase that we experienced in 2011. But that's not really saying much.
No, it isn't. They just keep kicking the can down the road for our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely the truth. At $16 trillion and growing every day, our federal debt will never be paid off by anyone who's in middle age right now. It will be their children and their grandchildren, possibly even their great-grandchildren, because even the debt negotiations we're talking about now is going to reduce our deficit to beneath $1 trillion toward the latter part of the decade. But, you know, that still does nothing for the increasing debt and the increasing liabilities and Medicare and Medicaid and, you know, all of the unfunded entitlements that, according to the former Comptroller General, the unfunded entitlements now are over $70 trillion.
Okay. Yeah, I don't like to think about that. They keep me awake at night, and I can't do much about it.
Yeah.
But give us some strategies that you and I as average citizens can use to maybe help break some of these barriers of the opposing ideologies. Well, you know, I feel so frustrated because I'll see an editorial or I'll read a blog or I'll hear something on the radio that makes sense, and yet the politicians totally ignore these solutions. We have that Deficit Reduction Commission that the Simpson-Bowles Commission came up with some at least talking points, and they're just basically totally ignored. How do we get action out of these politicians?
Well, I think it starts with the perspective, as I said. We have to shift the perspective from the Liberal Democratic Coalition and the Conservative Republican Coalition to a perspective and a focus of perpetual improvement. And the first step of that process is you have to recognize that both sides have valid observations.
Yeah.
And both sides have both contributions to make to the debate, and they also have errors that are woven through their thinking. And so you have to engage in a productive dialogue that focuses objectively, and I can't stress that enough, because objectivity if there's one concept that separates medieval world from modern world, it's objectivity and objective observation and analysis. So, in other words, when you start to look at a situation like healthcare or the debt or education reform, you don't do so with a whole host of initial assumptions and predetermined conclusions. Because once you do that, the baggage that you carry in, and that's what constantly has prevented the reconciliation over the past two decades, is the fact that every time they enter into a negotiation, they're carrying this giant luggage of initial assumptions and predetermined conclusions on their back.
Yeah, a classic example of that is this health care legislation, which, you know, it's 2,000 pages or whatever, and obviously there's going to be some huge flaws when they try to implement it. But when the other candidate, Romney, comes in and says, on day one, if I'm elected, I'm going to repeal the whole thing, that doesn't solve all the problems. There are obviously portions of that act that makes sense, so you don't just go say, I'm going to repeal the whole thing. You work together objectively to pull out the good and get rid of the bad and make the thing work.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. In fact, you know, the key issue, and even some of the Obama, President Obama's staff who worked on the legislation are now advocating in various editorials and other research papers that in order for the whole system to work, we have to dramatically reduce the costs.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And that's one of the issues that was part of Obamacare, but wasn't the central focus. And unfortunately, because the bill was put together more with an eye toward passing it rather than making sure that it effectively did what it set out to do, we're in a situation now where, you know, there's no guarantee that it's going to reduce costs meaningfully. And
no.
That is very bad, because that just blows up the Medicare formula even worse.
Yeah, if we'd only gone about that rationally with both parties involved and extended discussion rather than ramming through a 2,000-page bill that a lot of people hadn't even read,
yeah.
You know, we'd be a lot further along, and we wouldn't have all that bitterness that we've been hearing for months and months about how awful it is. We don't know that yet, really. But,
Well, and one very clear indication of what you're saying is that, you know, the famous healthcare summit that President Obama hosted was done in the spring of 2010, after the Senate had already passed its version and after the House version was 98% completed. So trying to have a productive dialogue when something's pretty much already fully baked is really not a way to have a reconciliation in any context.
Yeah, well, I certainly, your book sounds most interesting, and I guess you and I are not going to solve all the nation's problems. Hopefully, though, that you're getting a movement together and you'll get people together to put pressure on the politicians to get some things done. But let's talk about how we can bring this synthesis revolution closer to home. You know, each one of us at work or in our home family situations with our spouse, we're always going to have disagreements with a spouse. It may be over how we raise the children. We may have financial disagreements over how much money we should spend, how much we should save. With our children, we have disputes over how much authority they should have or how much independence. With neighbors, we may argue over the size and location of a proposed commercial development. There's all kinds of issues and disputes we deal with in our personal lives, and I would assume we could apply the same concepts that you talk about in your book in our personal lives and situations.
Yep, absolutely. And I think the major point there is something that I referred to earlier is the initial recognition that both sides have some legitimate observations, and both sides more than likely have error as well with their perspective. So the important issue is separating what's fact and separating what's opinion. And so, and that's, you know, a lot of times what happens in politics is the line between fact and opinion gets blurred. And so in your personal lives, recognize that the person you're talking to has a legitimate perspective. Look for elements of observation that he's making that are objectively valid that you share as well, and look to build on those shared assumptions and understandings. And then prove it. If something is not an objective fact, then try to look into it and see if you can do some research and validate that or disprove it. But that is a formula that really, you know, just that initial step of drawing a distinction between fact and opinion is incredibly useful and helpful in conversation.
And we may not be able to solve the world's problems, but if each one of us sits down and really thinks about it and follows that procedure, little by little, hopefully, the overall tenor of the country and the overall tenor of our daily living will change to one of respect and one of interest and real curiosity as to what benefits the other side may have, that we don't have all the right answers in our own minds.
Yep.
And your book, I understand, is coming out very shortly, and I certainly, from what we've talked today, it's something I'd be very interested in reading, and I'm sure the listeners would also. Can you tell us how they can obtain that book or what they should do to get more involved?
Absolutely. The website, which is going to be going live later this week, it's actually, you can go and sign up to get updates. It is just synthesisrevolution.com. That's synthesisrevolution.com. And all the information will be on there, how you can buy the book and join the movement and build the coalition of people focused on perpetual improvement and solving problems and help transform the country by improving the way that we make political and economic decisions.
And what do you intend for that, your movement, to actually do once it gets up and running? Do you have any definite plans in mind, or is that going to be determined by what the members want, or how's that going to work?
Well, the one of the key elements of what we're doing is we understand that we don't have all the answers, and by building a coalition of people who can contribute to the overall intellectual base and understanding of the problems, we can create a group of people focused on solutions. And you know, as the sort of vaunted independent voters of the last election, the independent and non aligned voters are the ones who are really going to make the decisions over the next few elections. The Democrats will have their core, and the Republicans will have their core. And what we're looking to do is put influence on the whole system by improving the debate and forcing politicians to answer difficult questions and become accountable. And if they're refused to be accountable,
it would be great if both those cores, in my opinion, shrunk, and that independent street core or group of people grew, and we got down where either side would have to depend totally on the people in the middle who have open minds to win the elections, and they can't depend on their own ideological core to do anything, because I think that's what's really leading to such disastrous campaigns and such disastrous results as we've been getting. But,
yep, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Tom, for joining us today. Once more, give us that website where people can get your book, because I'm sure it'll be very well received once it comes out.
Well, thank you. Yes, it's www.synthesisrevolution.com.
And well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be most interested to take a look at that book when it comes out.
Sounds great, Roy. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, as you know, the basic theme of our program is renewal of your mind and spirit at middle age. And if you're not enjoying life most every day and positively looking forward to a brighter tomorrow, it's time for you to wake up. We're not all about theory. We're about helping you. And most of us are familiar with the law of attraction. You attract positive circumstances into your life by thinking positive thoughts. But does it work for you? As our second guest today will explain, positive thinking is not enough. Heck, I've been thinking about winning the Powerball lottery jackpot for several years, but I haven't won it yet. Our guest is Dr. David Che, author of the new book, The Total Law of Attraction, Unleash Your Secret Creative Power to Get What You Want. Dr. Che has spent years researching the subject, and he's also a dentist, so if anyone out there needs a root canal, you've come to the right place. One critic called his book a GPS roadmap for lay people, and that's what we like, because we want common sense answers, not a bunch of theory. Less about the theory and more about here's how it works. Hello, Dr. Che, and welcome to our program.
Hi, Roy. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us why so many people think positive thoughts, but they don't succeed in attracting good things into their lives. In fact, too much positive thinking actually can work against you.
Well, a lot of this has started from my experience, is that there's just so many books and literature out there telling you, and even movies, telling you that, you know, positive thoughts, you know, you think positive, everything you attract into your life is from your thoughts. If you think positive, you get positive, you know, results. And I think that's partially true, but I think that's been overkill at the same time. And so the missing key, the missing factor, is not so much just having positive thoughts, but in order for those thoughts to manifest, you need a source of energy, and that source of energy is your emotions.
Yes.
People get too caught up in the thoughts and forget that in order for, you know, to have the thoughts manifest, you have to generate a strong sense of emotion inside your heart to, you know, fuel those thoughts to become reality. And so that's one of the main causes, I think, and that's very rarely mentioned in the literature about emotions and thought. It's just all about just think positive and you'll get positive, you know, results. And
yeah,
the main source
that
of the
emotions are so important. I know in my book I talk about imagination and visualization, thinking about the person you really want to become and letting that emotion sink in, and to think in terms of the person that you want to be before you're actually there. What are actually the four steps you mentioned in your book to attracting positives into your life? I think you mentioned like four stages.
Yes, after all the literature I've ever read, you know, there's, you know, trying to assimilate all the information, and it can be overwhelming, you know, all the information that's out there right now. I've really just kind of summarized it down into four main steps. If you want to attract anything, you have to have these four steps. And the four steps are, one, whatever it is you're trying to manifest, you have to obviously have the thought of it. You have to know exactly, clearly what it is you want. You can't have a vague desire. You have to know in detail what it is you want. So that's the thought of it. The second step is you have to attach a strong emotion to that thought. So, you know, if you're trying to manifest a new job or, you know, a new house, you have to have a strong feeling of desire, a strong feeling of wanting that, and knowing the feeling of having it already. You have to attach that emotion to that thought.
Yeah.
Thirdly, after you have the emotion and the thought, you have to have a belief that what you felt and see in your mind is true. And believe it or not, it's harder than most people think it is. Like, a lot of people
how do you
have
bring
the thought
that,
of it.
How do you bring the emotions into that true belief? That is a tough stage, I would think.
Well, I tell people this. If you can't generate a strong enough emotion trying to manifest, then you really don't, then you probably don't really want it, like as badly as you think you do. Because in order to attract something, people have these random desires saying, oh, I'm just going to attract something random. No. If you're trying to attract something, it must be a true heart's desire. And if it's a true heart's desire, if it's something you truly, really want in your heart, you will be able to generate a strong emotion towards it.
Yeah.
So, and lastly, which ties into what we're talking about here, after you have the thought, the emotion, and the belief, you still have to take massive action toward getting what you want. And so many people get so caught up in this. They think, oh, if I just sit around and eat ice cream all day and have a thought of, you know, and the feeling of what I want, it's just going to show up in front of me. And that's just not the case. Anything you want,
massive action is not just going out to buy a lottery ticket, I wouldn't think.
No. No, you have to have a lot of action. And the lottery thing is a separate category. Without getting too much into this, everybody always asks, well, you know, since you know so much about the law of attraction, how can I win the lottery using the law of attraction? And what I tell people, there's actually a scientific explanation to this, okay? And that's the things that you have the highest chance of attracting into your life are the ones that you keep to yourself that are very few people, that other people aren't aware of. Because on the quantum physical level, when you think about something and somebody else also has a thought of what you're thinking of, the same thing, they can alter that reality for you. So, again, without getting too deep into the physics of something, when you're trying to do a lottery or anything like the Powerball, you have millions of people playing the same game. So millions of people have the same kind of thought of winning the lottery. So it all basically cancels each other out in the end. So it's not very – the law of attraction is not a very reliable way of trying to win a lottery with. It's pure luck.
Yeah, I know an interesting point on your action is that you said you don't have to take the action right away. In fact, oftentimes it's better to let something sink in for a while rather than just plunging headlong right into the action.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the principle behind, you know, in my book, which I talk about. It's you still have to take massive action, but you don't have to take action right away. Let your subconscious mind, like when you're trying to attract something, you turn the thought from your conscious mind to your subconscious mind. And your subconscious mind needs time to work on what you're trying to attract. And over time, as you sit back and let your subconscious work, you know, not thinking about your desire all the time, your subconscious will give you the impulse, give you the insight, you know, to take certain sorts of action towards getting what you want. And when
you
start taking action,
is that what you mean when you talk about the law of detachment, kind of letting it go to come back?
That's exactly what it is. The law of detachment is the missing key in probably 99.9% of all of law of attraction books out there. And that's when you attract something, yes, you're thinking about it, but in order for you to successfully attract it, you have to detach and let it go. And that's something I go into great detail in my book about.
Oh, that sounds really fascinating. I know your book sounds like a real good roadmap, a practical guide to get there rather than just a bunch of theory. And how do people get your book then if they...
They can, as of now, and this is actually a perfect timing for our interview today, because for now they can go on to Amazon, you know, .com, and the book is called Total Law of Attraction, or they can go to my website, totallawofattraction.com. However, as we're speaking, I'm in contract negotiations with Simon & Schuster, which is the same publisher, The Secret, for them to buy the rights to my book. And once we sign the contract, which could be sometime this week or tomorrow for any chance, they will be in control of the book, and they're going to re-release the book under their name. So for maybe a week or two, the book might not be available because they're reformatting it for their name under their name. And once that happens, then you know, you can still check back on Amazon, but it'll be released under Simon & Schuster, not under myself anymore.
You tell people to not take action too soon, so if they have to wait a week or two, I guess it won't matter that much. But
yes,
I would highly recommend Dr. K's book, whatever the whoever issues it or wherever you get it. But and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
In wrapping up our program today, I would just like to second Dr. Che's remarks and emphasize how closely his four action steps tie in and parallel to the instructions and roadmap contained in my book, A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up. I don't strictly refer in my book to the law of attraction, but the law of attraction and the theory behind it show up throughout my book, and I'm strongly endorse the four steps that Dr. Che mentioned in his interview. In my book, let's just go as an example to a chapter on finding a new job called Taking a Mental Vacation to Find your True Vocation. The first step is thinking positive thoughts, and in talking about that, I tell people to think about and write down an ideal position description. Forget all the restrictions and things that have been holding you back, and write down what you'd really like to be doing if someone would pay you to have a good time. And in the second step, we bring out the positive emotions, and in that stage, imagine yourself in that ideal job and let your positive emotions run free. And one thing I'd like to add right here that Dr. Che didn't mention, use your imagination and visualization. Fill in all the details and imagine what it would be like having what you really want to do for a living or whatever the will or desire that you have. Be firm in your objectives, but flexible in your details, and you can't limit yourself only to one potential employer. That's the true belief. You truly believe that you will find the job of your dreams. You obviously don't know for sure if it will be with XYZ company or any other one particular employer, but you know that you will achieve that action. And then finally, there's the fourth, the action step, and obviously that includes networking and other things that you do in a marketing campaign, marketing one product and one product only, and that is you and your services. Once a clear opportunity comes forward, you immerse yourself for a week or however much time you have in getting ready, say, for a key interview by studying that potential employer, every aspect that you can, so that you, in effect, know what's going on in that company and are willing to sell and are ready to sell yourselves in that particular job that is opening or potential opening that you know about. And the key thing when you're preparing an action is to think of yourself in this manner. Say it's a financial executive job that you seek. You say to yourself, I am a CFO. How can I apply my known talents and abilities to be the CFO for XYZ company? And since you've been studying and immersing yourself in that company, you know what they're looking for, and you think and behave like an incumbent because you have used the law of attraction effectively to get your subconscious mind in the proper mindset. And guess what? When you show up for the interview, you're going to be miles ahead of your competition who doesn't really think of themselves as CFO or whatever the job is in that particular company. So I would strongly endorse both Dr. Che's book and also my own, because we're not just talking about the law of attraction. We're talking about renewing you at middle age, bringing out the real you, waking up from the you that's been sleeping through so many years. And once again, the name of my book is A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up. It's available through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com or through our website, www.middleagerenewal.com. That's all one word. And we thank you so much for joining our program today. We'll see you again next week.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.